This is the first time that I really felt what you mean by cell relation. You know, you have this object relation and you have part object relations and anxieties that are depressive and schizophrenic. But you, when you deal with primitive anxieties, you really, I really felt cell relation. I really felt that what I feel is like cells going beyond my skin. And I felt that she feels that my cells are going beyond her skin. So it's like a transference. It's a diffuse transference. So when I realized that you have this sort of transference, it really took me to prenatal life and biology life. And I also had all those, you know, theoretical people, testing, Meltzer, Beyond, they were all talking about that.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Cherie Ben-Bissat, who is a clinical psychologist and a psychoanalyst with the Israeli Psychoanalytic Society. She is also an immunologist, and our conversation today revolves around her understanding of how immunologic processes inform analytic and developmental processes, especially as they apply to primitive mental states. And she demonstrates this in a remarkable accounting of an analysis with a four-year-old, very disturbed and very disturbing girl, who really challenged the boundaries of their encounter. She is a supervisor at the Franz Brill Mental Health Center in Tel Aviv, and she teaches in various programs in the Studying Center of the Israeli Psychoanalytic Institute. She recently won the 24th Francis Tustin Memorial Prize. I learned a great deal from my conversation with her and reading her work. It's a whole new dimension, at least for me, of appreciating the immunologic system and how that can represent, and maybe not even represent, but literally apply. That's the conversation we have, whether it's a metaphor or whether it's actually the case, the inside and the outside, both immunologically and psychoanalytically. Here's my conversation with Cherie Ben-Bissat. Cherie, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you here. We have been learning that the journey to become a psychoanalyst is unique to all of us. We all have our personal stories that lead us to study this work and practice this work. Some of us have traditional routes to getting here. We go through various graduate programs directly after college. And we're learning that there are many people who have what we could call untraditional routes. I've spoken to analysts who've had prior careers as a nephrologist, in the education world, as neurologists, and you were an immunologist. But you not only were an immunologist, you bring your immunological thinking and reasoning and knowledge, and you feel it's directly related to your understanding as an analyst. In fact, let me read a couple of sentences from a paper you've written on that subject. You wrote, quote, "I propose that far from being a metaphor for psychic processes, the immune system has a crucial impact not only on our survival ability, but on the basic structure of mental development, on the connection forged between the familiar and the strange, new and old, interior and exterior, a movement that has been entirely arrested in the case of some of our patients." Now, that's quite a statement, the issue that it is not a metaphor, but an actual biological phenomenon. And we're going to spend some time talking about that. And we're going to talk about it in relation to a remarkable treatment that you have written up, the treatment of a very disturbed and disturbing four-year-old girl. But before we get to that, tell us about your journey. What brought you to immunology? And from there, how did you get to psychoanalysis?
Okay, so hi. I started learning biology, I think, something approximately 35 years ago or 30 years ago. I came from a very realistic house, so I was not familiar with psychology at all. And I was very interested in biology and how things is working on bodily and the bodily phase. So I learned psychology and I learned biology. And in my third year of biology, or my first degree, we had this course in immunology. And there was a lecturer, his name was David Weiss, which say something that really caught my ears and was very strange for my ears. He said that the immunological system is being influenced by stress conditions. And it was very strange for me because I never thought of biology that is being influenced by psychology. So from there on, I continue in his lab and I continue to my second degree, my master's. And we were doing such a, we were having such a research of trying to investigate this field of the connection between biology and psychology. So we were testing medical students. They were in front of their final exam, and we were taking blood from them really in front, really before the test. And parallel to that, we were collaborating with the psychology department, and they were giving them stress exams, stress tests. It was like 35 years ago. It was very, now everybody's talking about the connections between the body and soma, but yeah, then sure. it was very a new idea. So we really had these results that were very, very interesting for me, because I thought we'll find results that as stress is elevating, the immune system ability to defend the body is reducing. That's what I thought. And what we received was like a bell diagram when you can see that there is sort of amount of anxieties that are very important for the immune system. And it was so strange for me and for the people from the psychology department. They were very happy. And they said some words, well, it's exactly like Lanyon theory, which said that the anxiety have like a two-edged sword. When it is when you don't have anxiety, you cannot develop. And when they were very happy.
Well, let me ask you a question, make sure I understood what you said. The psychology department was happy with the results of this research because it demonstrated the accuracy of Kleinian principles?
Yes.
Is that
exactly
right? Well, I note that because I don't think there is a psychology department in the United States at this time, and perhaps not even then, that had any interest in, much less knowledge of, either Kleinian or Freudian or anybody else's analytic principles. So I'm just taking note that at that moment in time, we'll see if it's true now, there was an attunement to a dynamic understanding of how the mind worked.
Yes, it was.
And so that drew you into or alerted you to the world of analytic thinking?
Yes, it was very interesting for me because it was a wide thinking, and also they were talking with the students, and it made me, I really liked it. I went to the lab and was dealing with tubes and with the blood and making tests, and they were talking to the students, and it was much more interesting.
You'd rather be talking to the students, yeah. Yeah, a lot of us went through the basic sciences with that same spirit. So then what happened? So you realized there was this whole world of talking to students that was different than taking blood from students, right? And then what happened?
So then I did parallel things. I finished my master's in this in the immunological department, and I started to learn psychology and also went to therapy, of course. And I finished my master's and finished my first degree in psychology, and closed the door of the biology section of my life, and I thought I would have done it forever. And started and went to a master's in clinical psychology. And
what made you go from clinical psychology to psychoanalysis? Because one has many choices with a degree in clinical psychology.
I've been doing a regular therapy once a week, and I really wanted to expand my knowledge of psychoanalysis. I didn't think from the beginning that I will become a psych. I didn't know what psychoanalysis is exactly. Mm-hmm. So I decided that I will go to learn psychoanalysis. And in Israel, for learning psychoanalysis, you must be in analysis by yourself for at least one year. So I went to analysis because this is what I had to do. And then I really discovered a new world.
Right. Your course was different than some of the people I've spoken with. They discovered their interest in training as an analyst through their experience of being in analysis. That is, they started as an analyst and then discovered the wish and the initiative to become an analyst. Your journey is a little bit different, yeah?
Yes, maybe you can say it's my scientific mind that I wanted to have knowledge about psychoanalysis, but I really found a very I found it very interesting to be an analyst.
Sure. And did you from the beginning see a correlation between the immunologic model and the dynamic unconscious model? How'd that come about?
No, not at all. It took a lot from the beginning as a psychologist, of course not. And from the beginning of the training as an analyst, I did not. It started when I start my first case in the analysis, my first case in the training period. I've had this autistic psychotic child whom I wrote about it, Yael.
Right.
And then learning about such primitive anxieties led me to the thinking of, first of all, of bodily issues, and then of the immune system. It led me back to the immune system, because the immune system is the somatic counterpart for distinguishing between the familiar and not familiar. And in primitive anxieties, you really act like a very sensitive immune system. Everything is threatening. So it was the beginning of my thinking about the immune system as a crucial role and having crucial role in the psychic development.
Let me read what you've written on that. You write, quote, I would like to propose that in biological terms, the embryo's ability to successfully root itself in the uterus and to develop normally depends on the transformation of the mother's lethal NK cells, which are natural killer cells, into life-giving cells. In psychodynamic terms, this is a transformation of the destructive drive of the death instinct into the life-giving drive of the libido, which depends on the constitutional balance between these two forces. Tell us a little more about that. It's an intriguing correlation.
Yes. We used to think, like, I think 40 years ago, that the life in the womb, the prenatal life, are very harmonic ones. But in the last 40 years, we find out that it's really in the contrary. The sperm, from the moment it gets inside the vagina and even afterwards, is always in a battle. He always in object relation that he needs to fight for himself. So it starts from the beginning when he has like immune cell in the vagina that he needs to like move behind them or like go although they're there. And then the blastocyte, the blastocyte is like when the embryo is 8 cells or 10 cells, mm-hmm. He needs to penetrate to the uterine lining cells of the mother. And he needs to like do a lot of, like he needs to release a component that attacks his mother uterine lining cell that he can penetrate inside it. The mother uterine lining cells is totally stranger for her. So it does not let her in. And afterwards, he meets with his mother immune cells. And the important thing and the very, very interesting thing was that we found that in the decidua is the thing that connects the embryo and the mother. It's mm-hmm. the thing in the placenta that connects between the embryo and the mother. So in this decidua that you would have thought that you don't need to have immune cells of the mother, you find out that 40% of the cells inside them are the immune system cells. And between them, most of them are NK cells. NK cells, it's natural killer cells. They're the most lethal cells that we have in the body. So it was very interesting how the embryo can survive. And what we find out that the embryo has in embryo is like 2 weeks or something like this, 3 weeks. He needs to release and like sort of a protein that connect to his mother's NK cells and transform these cells in a unique way that you don't have it at all in the body. It is the only place it calls it could transform the NK cells to good cells for the embryo. So they are now not attacking it, but on the contrary, they're helping to penetrate the uterine lining cells and they influence the cognitive development of the mind. So now, these NK cells, this is yes. the only place you find them in these 3 months of the pregnancy.
Now, your thesis, tell me if I have this right, is that that transformation from destructiveness to acceptance is parallel to what happens in development, where the now infant, we're talking about after birth, the infant destructiveness gets soothed by the mother's receiving it and transforming it through her goodness into something loving and accepting, metabolizing, and growth enhancing. Yeah?
Yeah, this is one way of looking at it from this side, but the same thing you can say that the baby, when he was born, when he's born, he needs to transform
okay.
the aggressive of his mother because he projects his aggression as in death instinct on the mother. So it is very important for the baby to feel that it is like a very successful event and very, and it imprints itself on the structure when you're an embryo and in your experience when you are a baby. that you really succeed to transform. It's really an act of strength to feel like that.
It didn't take us long to get to the central issue, which is it the mother's actual goodness that helps with that function, or is the mother existing only as a projection in the infant's mind? We can agree that we're not going to solve that problem right at this moment. but your point is an important one, which is that it is a bilateral process, and that is that there are certain babies who awaken that goodness in others and others who not so much.
And the babies who not survive, this is not a problem. It's a problem, but it's not a problem for us. And the baby who survive and when the embryo is getting birth, if he is like already has succeeded of something. It's like Meltzer. Meltzer said that all this prenatal life, the aim is to prepare the child for the catastrophic change of the birth and all the catastrophic change that will be afterward. So some of the embryos really equipped with the ability to do that. But then you have this in the midst embryos who have succeeded to stay alive, but the attack was very, very hard. So I think that they are born with imprinting in the DNA through epigenetic mechanisms of a very uncanny world, very uncanny and dangerous world. They were not, they survived, but they survived with an imprinting of an uncanny world. And this is
how... Uncanny world, did you say? Is that the word you used?
Uncanny.
Uncanny, yeah, okay.
Yes, because it now, is a world that nourish you and attack you both in the same time.
That's what you meant by constitutional balance.
Yes.
Yes. Tell us about epigenetics. When I first learned about it, I was really startled. I was startled to learn that not just that when one is in utero, the environmental factors affect all of us who are in utero. That seems reasonable and understandable, but that it affects the next generation. Because the impact on all of us when we're in utero is not just on us, but it's also on our hereditary cells, our sperm and our ovum, which are inside us when we're a fetus. So those hereditary cells are impacted so that the next generation is impacted. I've also read recent studies that say that actually what happens to our parents before we were conceived affects the next generation. And they've studied this in their famous Swedish studies of famine, where communities were starved, and then they were able to trace them through very accurate records for a number of generations and could see the impact preconception on subsequent generations. It's quite startling. But let's return to how you understand it in as part of the dynamic process.
Okay, that was a question. How we know about transgeneration and transmission, we knew it for many years, and then I think we thought it is. We didn't know how does it happen. I think we thought it's like an object relation when the mother has from her mother sort of object relation. She transmit it to her child in a realistic object relation, but then we had this knowing about epigenetics that is a way to transmit from one generation to another things that control the DNA. Because the DNA itself, it cannot be changed through one generation or two or three. It is very difficult to change the components of the DNA itself. But this epigenome, it's up the genes, epigenome's layer comes together with the DNA. It's transmitted through the sperm and egg, and it controls the DNA. It controls the translation of proteins from the DNA. So we knew about this epigenetic because any cells in our body has all the DNA for all the cells. It can differentiate to any cells, but this epigenetic control makes, you know, the kidney cell produce the protein for the kidney and the eye cell You understand that.
Yes.
So, but what we found out in the last year that it controls the release of components that influence object relations, that influence how we perceive the world, if in paranoid world, if autistic way, it influences our ability to make mental schemas, like to project and to interact. It influences all the things. So that's what we found out, that that the epigenetics can be transmitted and influence our object relation, our sense of self, our the way we see the world. So this is how, and if, for example, there's a lot of literature about the Holocaust. Okay.
But are you saying that what happened to our grandparents biologically impacts the kind of object relations we're able to form or are inclined to form?
Yes, influence is a big word. I think there is a link because there's a lot of other things that happen in the way. You know, the sperm is going into the prenate, into the, his mother womb, and a lot of things happen there.
Okay.
But there is a link.
A link, okay. Let's talk about Yael. I thought one way we can do this would be for you to read what is a striking piece of the encounter between the two of you. But before we get to that, introduce her to us as she was introduced to you. Who was she when you met her?
Okay, she was 4 years old. She was my first analysis in the training. She was introduced to me as autistic child. Who were adapted in when she was 1 year and 2 months. She was adapted to an Israeli family who had a very good experience with her older son, so they didn't expect any problems that will be. She was
their first son was also adopted, but not yes. related to this person, different family, right?
Yes, but he was adapted after 3 months and. Yael was adapted as 1 year and 2 months. This is a long way to be with. Mm-hmm. This is different. So,
and where what was the setting she was in for her first year?
She was born. We don't know a lot, but she was born to an addicted to drugs and alcoholistic mother that was very lonely, who left her in the hospital. But she'd been, I think, for 2 weeks, and then she was moved to an orphanage. Her parents told me that the orphanage looked very poor and very empty, but they really liked, they saw her and she looked very calm and very restrained. She was not crying.
This was not an Israeli orphanage. This was from a different country, yeah?
Yes, it was not in Israel.
Yeah.
And she was not crying. The other babies or child, she was 1 year and 2 months, they were crying and she was not crying. So they decided to take her. But from the moment she got to Israel, she really didn't stop crying. And she was not only crying. She was screaming a lot and she was stopping her breathing like apnea. And she had such a panic attack. And it was really three horrible years for her parents because it was not expected and it was very difficult. And they couldn't know how to deal with her. After 2 years, they reached to a kindergarten that is that the pop, they deal with children like that. And that was a little bit of relief. But although the screaming and the... and she was not talking. She was like 3.5, 4 years old and she was not talking yet. And she really has this, a lot of screaming. They were talking about all of it and they couldn't talk to her. And that's how she came to analysis.
Before you start reading, let me just underline something you said in case our listeners missed it. This was your first analytic case. And I don't know which is more startling, that this was your first case or that you were assigned this case as a first case. But in either case, I would advise the listeners to really appreciate the profundity of the work, how you made yourself so available to this child in ways that, whether the NK cell model is a metaphor or is an actuality, you obviously, through something that you brought to this encounter, brought some goodness to this young child's life that forever changed it. With that as an introduction, why don't you start by sharing this one piece of your encounter?
So I start reading from the paper. So the first months of the analysis were characterized by a recurrent pattern, which was established during our first meeting. At the beginning of the session, Yael attempted to cut out various shapes of cardboard and to glue them to each other. Her failure to successfully perform this task led her to tear the cardboard, throw all the books from the library, and attempted to flee the room. She was very angry. Facing the closed door, because I didn't let her go out from the office, she shouted and threw herself repeatedly against it in a manner that appears to me very painful. Any type of interpretive connection I attempted to offer as a container for her frustration and anxiety only led to further escalations. All I remembered retrospectively was the experience that anything I tried to say rendered those outbursts more extreme, and the thought that I would do better to remain silent. But even when I kept silent and refrained from looking at her, and even when she shut her eyes and ears in her heart-wrenching attempts to seal off all her openings, she still appeared to be under an intolerable attack. The scream was so intense that neighbors in the buildings knocked on the door to make sure I wasn't abusing her. And subsequently, when the screams didn't stop, they even warned me that if this went on, they would have to ask me to move my clinic out of the building. The chaos that I left behind her in the room was so great that I had to cancel the following meeting in order to put things back in order. Yael's mother, who heard the screams while waiting outside, hesitated about pursuing the analysis, yet seems to experience some relief when she realized she wasn't the only one who was being screamed at. During those first weeks, I felt myself to be an analyst carrying a high-risk pregnancy, with attacks occurring both within and without. When Yael went out of control, I was horrified by the idea of being forced to leave the clinic, while simultaneously feeling that I was just making things worse, that my eyes and my breathing were causing her such a catastrophic anxiety. At the end of each of this meeting, I couldn't remember anything except for the image of being in the presence of a burn victim stripped of his skin, for whom the slices breeze was experienced as an intolerable form of torture. About 2 months into the analysis, while she was screaming, Yael suddenly stopped breathing and fell on the couch. Though her parents had described frequently bouts of apnea, starting a day after she arrived in Israel, and leading to panicky trips to the emergency room, for one dreadful moment, I really feared that she was dead. I checked on her while continuing to talk, saying that I understood how much she feared for my penetration, and that this was her final, desperate attempt to seal herself off so I would not be able to get into her. Yael curled up in a fetal position, quietly withdrawing into herself. I thought how great the danger was, and quietly said that I could sense how unprotected and skinless she felt in the womb. Several meetings later, during another screaming fit, I felt an urge to disappear. I walked behind the wall that partially divided my consulting room and remained silent. After a while, I noticed that the room had grown quiet. I said, "Now there is a wall between us. I'm on this side of the wall, and Yael is on the other side. The wall is thick and strong, ensuring that nothing bad for me can reach to you." Yael responding by saying that now I should stop breathing as well. And so I did, for as long as I could, feeling that every breath of mine releases a stream of toxic element that could attack her.
Thank you for sharing that. And just to continue on, you write, at the beginning of the following meeting, Yael came in and uttered her first sentence in the course of the analysis. So something in your enactment with her allowed her to feel settled both with you and inside herself so that she could now utter a sentence. What was the sentence? She said, "You are Miriam and you have to build an ark for the baby Moses so that he won't drown." And so you did. You built a paper ark. And that was a turning point in the treatment. Tell us what happened in subsequent years and what the outcome was.
That really was a turning point because I think she could have felt what we were talking about, the embryo, that she really can control my presence or my cells. And from that point, I was very frequently standing behind the wall. And she started, it was very exciting because she started very slowly coming to my side and looking at me and taking things from my side. And it's really, it just came to me that she's making this womb or myself more familiar for her and less threatening. And that was the way she did it for almost, I think, 1 month or 2 months. And then was the then she asked me to wrap her with a masking tape.
And this is an amazing story. You went through, she asked you to wrap her up, her whole body in tape.
Yes.
And she needed this repeated so many times. You said you went through 200 rolls of masking tape, wrapping her up.
Yeah, that was like, I think, 5 months or something like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then what developed after that?
So when she succeed to make this splitting between me and her with this mask and tape, she really felt her cells together with mask and tape, the same as the skin is for the body. And she really created a differentiation between inside and outside and felt protected. She wanted me, we started like splitting processes. She wanted me to be the wolf and she like moved between, she asked me to feed her and then she asked me to threaten her and she was moving in this place of seeing myself as sometimes as good and sometimes as bad. So it's like was the development of the of a mental state.
Yeah, the capacity to split. Usually we think of splitting as a regressive defense, but for her it was progress.
Yes, for primitive anxiety, splitting is really a relief and it's very good. Yes.
And when she asked you to feed her, did you?
We were playing.
I wasn't being critical. I was just curious.
Yes,
oh, so
yes,
she you did feed her or you played with feeding her?
No, we were playing.
Uh-huh. And she could entertain the play of being fed.
Yes.
Didn't need it literally.
Yes, from that moment she was amazing in her imaginary world and the way she created world in the therapy and the analysis, it was great.
You know what's so funny for me is here you say she was amazing in her imaginative ability to use the analysis. Those are exactly my words that I have towards you in your role in her life and in the analysis. It's amazing how you brought your imaginativeness. And I have this hunch that those two are related experiences.
It was very difficult. I had my supervision. Without my supervision, I would not survive. And
right.
I really, it was very difficult. I asked my supervisor to record the meetings because I couldn't remember nothing. I was not in a good shape, but I had a good supervision, a very good supervision.
Oh, how nice. And what was the outcome of the case?
The outcome of Yael?
Yes, of Yael. What happened?
So there was a lot of outcomes. It was 4 years analysis. And when she finished analysis after 4 years, she we said goodbye, and then she came back when she was 12 years old, like for her, she got her period and all her primitive anxieties came back to her, and she needed like a 1 year of therapy. She came once a week and she needed to think about them again and in therapy. And she said to her mother that I'm the only one who could understand such, because she was really, she had these primitive anxieties. She continued having them, but she could have dealt with it.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. That's, it's very moving. Was it through the work with Yael that you put these two models together, the immunologic model and the analytic model?
This is the first time that I really felt what you mean by cell relation. You know, you have this object relation and you have part object relations and anxieties that are depressive and schizophrenic. But you, when you deal with primitive anxieties, you really, I really felt cell relation. I really felt that what I feel is like cells going beyond my skin. And I felt that she feels that my cells are going beyond her skin. So it's like a transference. It's a diffuse transference. So when I realized that you have this sort of transference, it really took me to prenatal life and biology life. And I also had all those, you know, theoretical people testing Meltzer, Beyond, they were all talking about that.
And where do you see the future? How do you plan to, if you do, how do you plan to integrate these two in your thinking, in your writing, in subsequent cases? Because it's a very unique contribution that you're making. And it comes from your both backgrounds in immunology and analysis. Where would you like to be with this in 5-10 years?
You know, Freud said that biology is an unlimited land, and it will widen our knowing of things. I think we need to gather more evidence, because Yael, it's like 8 years old or something like that. And from then, I really heard a lot of things and really passed through a lot of things in my office that opened the mind to this. To this material. So I think we have to gather more evidence, and I think we need to collaborate with scientists and see what happens in the beginning, in the prenatal life. We can look at it as infant observation and learn a lot of the beginning of development, because we all have been going through that, and we all have sort of cellular memories that are from that period. So we need to collaborate with scientists. And also, I think I want to dare to think that we can start giving interpretation about the structure, about the biology. We can give maybe after many years in analysis. And besides interpretation of content, I think we can give interpretation of the structure, of the biology structure. And in this way, maybe we can go through, you know, Freud said that the biology field is like a rock, that our work has to stop there. But I think maybe knowing biology now, what we know now, maybe we can also make some interpretation about that.
Well, I think we can do that, but I think the only way we can really do that is if someone like yourself, who can bring not just your deep knowledge of biology, but also, if I may say, your stunning, gracious way of reaching deep into someone's, not just their cellular processes, but their soulful processes. And I think as long as we keep an eye on doing both of those things, I think the future is as promising as you just outlined.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Sheree, thank you so much for this. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners both learned a lot and will want to know more. And I look forward to your next papers. We'll come back and we'll revisit it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again for chatting with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.